some of those, some of us who are not happy about it, but I...
Oh, I mean, that's an arrangement that they make themselves. Maybe one, I've seen them work for 2 years, and then say, well, I'm going to be, now it's your turn. And they might not say it quite that way, but the expectation is that now it's your turn to go work.
The one thing that I found in my study of subsistence is that the socioeconomic unit tends to be kin-based. A whaling crew will usually select its crew members from the paternal side. I've broken the social unit down into various categories. One is a subsistence harvester, those individuals who actually actively engage in the hunt or gathering. The subsistence recipient, those individuals who receive subsistence products through feasts or ceremonies, or through various other cultural mechanisms which promote sharing and exchange. This area I liken to a social welfare system. In a Western or American system, we see that we have social welfare in institutions. In subsistence economies, we see that often elderly individuals are the recipient of goods. There are the cultural values, the cultural norms that promote that sharing with the elderly, and also with the needy. I found that people were classifying needy as those families without active hunters. So you might have a widowed woman who doesn't have a hunter in her family. And you'll find that the cultural values promote sharing with those individuals. So I classify those people as social subsistence recipients. Also, there are individuals who I call financial sponsors. And that speaks for itself. I said that generally the socioeconomic units are kin-based, but not necessarily so. There are some instances of individual hunters and individuals going out by themselves to hunt. And a lot of it depends on the conditions. If you're out on the ice, you usually try to have a hunting partner. Or if you're going inland by snow machine for 100 miles or so, then you usually try to have a hunter, another partner.
You relate that to sort of social welfare. That brings up a lot of bad connotations.
No, it doesn't. Why should it? It's a mechanism to take care of individuals in their society. I think that's a beneficial mechanism. When you compare it to, like, the bad things, misuse on social welfare in the Western system, that's a negative connotation, but not when you view it as, how it functions in a subsistence system. There might be individuals who might be lazy,
who might not go out and hunt, then we might see an abuse of it. But when you have a system that functions to take care of those people, such as the elderly or those needy people, then it's a functional system. It's a system that takes care of itself. Value judgment is something else.
Yeah, I think that could be stated for both examples as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And what was it that the recipient gives something up or back to
you? Yes. Yeah. They might also be responsive. If an elderly has social security, they might go and buy gas or buy some ammo or buy them coffee or bread, something like that. That's a financial sponsor. So the individuals can, you know, they can alternate or sometimes they can be both.
Do you think that there's obviously not as much abuse with this kind of a subsistence welfare type social? Could you distinguish the difference? I mean, I feel like when you connect them, you connect the negative thing.
Connected the negative thing, not me.
Yeah.
You're connecting the abuse.
I'm connecting
the functional. I'm looking at functional relationships. It's just something that you have to distinguish.
Usually this discussion on subsistence is about 4 or 5 weeks. I'm trying to condense it for you guys. Okay, let's look at the cultural aspects of subsistence. First of all, culture has been classically defined as the modes of thought, the ideologies, the total range of customary behavior transmitted from one generation to another through the social group, thus enabling the society to maintain itself. This interrelationship between the hunter and his and her environment is based on several thousand years of evolution, cultural evolution. The persistence of subsistence has been largely attributed to this cultural tenacity or their cultural relationship to their environment. Usually it's referred to as cultural heritage. And I always say this return to the land syndrome practiced by some individuals who have rejected the capital system and their own society is a situational product. Unless that individual becomes integrated into a functioning subsistence system. I know a lot of you have heard about, you know, the return to the land individuals, and there's some up in the Northwest area where they went out and said, I'm going to be subsistence. And by the way, I was misquoted, I think, in Natural Magazine or something, where I was talking about this kind of individual. This kind of an individual, that's situational. You know, it's best explained by psychological analysis, not by cultural and social analysis. But an individual, a non-native, let's say, may become integrated into a system, and I've seen many of them, you know, in many communities, become integrated and become a functioning part of that system. But when I talk about subsistence, I'm talking about systems, not individuals.
However, the Sportsmen's Association would maintain that their families and their grandfathers and back to the days when they were fighting the Indians in the West have been part of a system in which, for them, subsistence is part of their life.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they use that, and I don't listen to them too much, but it would almost seem valid from what you're saying,
mm-hmm.
as an argument.
Yeah. I've advocated a study of sports hunters, because in the literature we don't know too much about sports hunters. We don't know who they are. We don't know. We don't have any hard data on their economic background, their educational background. We have no. You know, we haven't done any kind of work on sports hunters. I think it'd be worthwhile to do it. So anyway, when we're talking about cultural aspects of subsistence, we're talking about cultural values and ideologies. What are those values that promote them going out, working, you know, on a whaling crew? What are the cultural ideologies that promote sharing? You know, what makes them share with the elders? And this is the most difficult and probably the most emotional to even discuss. The area where you see the most overt manifestations of the cultural aspects of subsistence is primarily in ceremonies and their art and their dancing. And here it becomes, you know, it's real evident. You could see that kind of relationship that they have with their environment. The other things, other cultural values, are really hard to take a look at. And I don't know that anyone has really, you know, studied the early socialization patterns, you know, that promote sharing. But we do know that they do have them, but we don't know a whole lot about how it's transformed. So, in summary, I'll say that subsistence, in my opinion, according to my analysis, occurs within a social and cultural aspect or component, but it can be viewed as an economic system as well. I think I'm going to leave it at that, and if anyone has any questions or any other areas in subsistence that they want to talk about, we can go ahead and do that. As we might guess, subsistence activities are enmeshed in an array of international laws and treaties, national statutes, public policies, and most recently within state laws and regulations. We see that these regulations and these management regimes usually dictate the season, the geographical boundaries of the hunt, the duration of the production season, harvest levels, the techniques and technologies that are allowed to be used in the procurement, as well as utilization. So when you have legislation that dictate all these kind of variables, then you might well imagine that subsistence laws and policies can influence or dictate the survival or else the extinguishment of subsistence, depending on how it goes. But it has been an area that, you know, that we haven't looked at thoroughly, even in the area of social scientists. A lot of the early studies that anthropologists did, all they did, when you look under economics, you'll see that they look at just the technology. They'll describe in detail all of the bows and arrows, boats, and everything like that. But it's been only recently that social scientists have begun to look at all of these other components of subsistence. And it's kind of too bad that we ended up with a law before, you know, we had formulated all of our studies. I just finished a study for Department of Fish and Game along with Dr. Langdon, where we looked at distribution systems. And I don't know what's going to happen with it, but at least it does show that there are distribution systems still functioning, and a lot of that has changed.
Just keep the same policy, like not disturb the natives and the use of land and resources.
Well, that would be really nice if people were living in isolated worlds. But today, it's not happening that way. So I guess policymakers feel like they either have to protect the hunters, protect the environment, and also watch for the activities that affect that, affect the subsistence. And I might urge you that don't be so concerned about what's going on with your fish and wildlife or your fish and game regulations. Be also concerned about native corporations and their potential impact on subsistence. And in some instances, not potential, but actually real impact. Impact that is already occurring. When you look at ANCSA and you see how we have that checkerboard, how our land holdings are fragmented, and you see how the corporations are mandated to be profit-making corporations, you see that sometimes their activities are going to be in conflict with subsistence hunters, such as at Anaktivi Pass, where the regional corporation put up an oil well, and the hunters maintained that the noise disturbed the caribou migration. And so that year they had a very difficult time with their, they didn't have enough caribou. Or else right now the conflict between corporations and whalers. And sometimes they're one and the same people with just different hats. So the conflicts, are from a lot of different areas.
On this D2 land bill, I'm not really sure, will the natives still be able to hunt on the lands that are designated?
Yeah.
They'll be able to hunt on refugees.
I think not.
Can I use your definition of conservation?
Of what?
Can I use your definition?
Oh, it's not mine. You're welcome to use it. That was from the Council of Anthropology in 1936 or something like that. Oh, you mean that one where I did that? Yes. Oh, yes. Please do. Okay, I'll give it to you. Okay.
Since you're our first female lecturer, and the men always gave us a short biography, and since I think you're what role model? I assume you're native.
Oh yes.
Yeah. Would you tell us about a little about your background,
okay,
and schooling and so on?
Okay, I'm Tlingit. I grew up in the Southeast. I'm from Haines. I'm from Klukwan. I'm Shumba Kwedi is my clan. I lived in Southeast until 10 years ago. I got very angry about 12 years ago at what was going on. I got involved with OEO, and I was very frustrated because I was not educated. And all the liberals kept saying, well, tell us what to do. And I could say, well, how can I tell you? I'm not educated. You're the one who went to school. You tell me how we're supposed to correct the system. I got so frustrated, and at the time I was directing the higher education program, Alaska Native Brotherhood Higher Education Program, sexist name. But anyway, I started recruiting natives to school. We had 30 kids in college. We now have close to 500 Tlingit in college. I always say that the program was so good that I recruited myself and I went to school. And I graduated from AMU. I took joint classes at AMU and it was then ACC. And I was so angry that I hadn't been able to learn all of that. And it was really like a new world opening up for me when I became educated. As I was becoming educated, I was ready to graduate. And I said, I'm not ready to graduate. I have just begun to learn. So I applied to graduate school. I went to Harvard. I did 3 years there, got my master's there. I'm working on my doctoral dissertation now. If I wasn't involved with whaling, I probably would have finished it. So I'm taking leave of absence this coming fall. And I'm involved in hunting, whaling. My research has taken me in the last 5 years, you know, to all the northern whaling communities. I'm starting to do research on beluga hunting. I'm also president of the Alaska Native Education Association. And also, I was the first chairperson of the Alaska Native Women's Group, formed in 1977. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who?
In fact, I was one of the people that asked to hold this over so we could work on an interim, and then I didn't have a chance to an interim, it's my fault, but because I was too busy with other matters to really concentrate on this deal, and consequently it comes up before us again, and I'm still just in the same position, being very critical and not having a lot of positive things to contribute. But I did spend about 3.5 hours on it today, and I think I have there is a way to rationalize this whole process here. One of the things that I've been reacting to very strongly is that it's so chaotic. It's completely, it's not based on any kind of work of philosophy. The original idea, just based on 10% of the vacant land, didn't really make a lot of sense in terms of being rational as some sort of formula. And then it got worse as we picked certain things and made parks out of them, and there's other kinds of entitlements and classifications. So that now it has absolutely nothing to do with any kind of rational formula that one would make based on any kind of procedure. So I think there's a way, though, Mr. Chairman, and I know everyone's very reluctant to open up this bill because it is such a Pandora's box, too, and that they think everything will break apart and that all the people that have now come together and agreed will jump off and it will just be terrible. But I do think that there is a way to rationalize this, and we just played around with it today and had a three-factor formula, one of the factors being the old law, which I feel will reduce a lot of the inequities, will make it based on something reasonable and rational and take a lot of the chaos out of this thing, and won't change the numbers all that much for the people then who are very much wanting this legislation, that being Fairbanks, Mattsoon, and Kenai, the ones that are really making out well on it. I think we need to incorporate those other concepts and other amendments. So I would hope that the committee would see fit to work on this, to actually do some intense work on it. I think we can get it out in a week or 10 days. I really do. And I'd go through my suggestions if anyone would.
Well, that was the purpose of the meeting tonight. I'd like to ask if anybody has any further questions of Mr. Malone or whether he has something further to set forth for the committee, because what I'd like to do is end the formal session and start the work session, and we don't have to do all this formal stuff.
Is he going to join us in the, Mr. Chairman, is he going to join us in the informal session here, work session? Because I have a couple questions that I'd like to ask.
Mr. Chairman, one of the reasons I'm here is to protect the interests of my district in response to that comment. The other thing, though, is in terms of the final comment in your formal session, Mr. Chairman, is that the legislature, in in regards to this matter, they can do anything that's reachable by law. And the policies, for the most part, are based on the laws that the legislature passes. So that, you know, I think that this is a question where, in order to reach any sort of solution at all, the legislature is going to have to dictate the policy. And within that, they're going to have to work out the necessary compromises. But I think that since the situation has come up since the original provisions were put into the Borough Act, the questions are only going to be settled in the legislature.
What do you mean by the original Borough Act?
Well, the idea of being able to select 10% of the state land as vacant and unappropriated.
That was the original Borough Act. But the old boroughs were organized by their own action. The state didn't take part.
Depends on the borough you're talking about.
Okay, all right, I'm just leading you into a question. Why hasn't the state exercised the mandatory Borough Act? Want me to tell me that?
Okay,
that's a pretty good reason. But going farther back than that, isn't you know, what it goes back to the Constitution, that the legislature or the administration, somebody had to draw the borough line. Isn't that right? Nobody did it.
Well, the Constitution just says it's provided by law, and we set up the system, but we didn't actually draw the line.
Well, one way or another, those lines have to be established. But there's what's going to happen to the unorganized area of the state?
Let me call a formal session of this thing, you know, to a halt, and then we're going to start in the work session. I think we've reached a point where we can do that.